From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Family separation did not end with the executive order that ended the zero-tolerance prosecution policy. Families do continue to be separated by the border agencies for other reasons. Please do not let this become a story that passes from the front page and passes from memory the moment that it's not something that we're hearing about every morning.
After saying they'd remove 300 children from a Clint, Texas detention center, the Department of Homeland Security is moving 100 migrant children back. The children had been locked up in filthy conditions without adequate food, water, sanitation, or medical care. We'll speak with a Human Rights Watch researcher who was recently inside the jail. We'll also speak to a doctor who's become a government whistleblower after he was hired to inspect facilities where immigrant families are incarcerated. Plus, we speak to a Japanese-American psychotherapist who herself was born in a U.S. internment camp.
My name is Satsuki Ina. I'm a former child incarceree during World War II. This is a photograph of me when I was in prison. 75 years ago, 120,000 of us were removed from our homes and forcefully incarcerated in prison camps across the country. We're here today to protest the repetition of history.
But first, Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez will talk about his own experience meeting stranded migrant families in a Dallas airport. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Department of Homeland Security has moved 100 migrant children back to the Border Patrol jail in Clint, Texas, where a recent visit from lawyers revealed children of all ages have been locked up for weeks without adequate food, water, sanitation, or medical care, with older children having to care for younger ones. Around 300 children were removed from the jail Monday following widespread outrage over the reports. Meanwhile, the acting head of Customs and Border Protection, John Sanders, announced he's stepping down after just 2 months in the position. Acting Immigration and Customs Enforcement ICE Director Mark Morgan is set to replace Sanders. Morgan, an immigration hardliner, previously said in a Fox News interview that when he looked into the eyes of detained migrant children, he saw a, quote, soon-to-be MS-13 gang member. All top positions in Homeland Security agencies responsible for enforcing immigration policy are now being held by acting officials, meaning they were not approved by the Senate as the Constitution requires. We'll have more on this after headlines. A divided House approved a contentious $4.5 billion emergency funding package to address the border crisis Tuesday under growing pressure to address the Trump administration's inhumane treatment of migrants. The bill passed largely along party lines, with some progressive Democrats voting in favor after negotiating to include provisions including new health and safety standards for jailed migrants. Four Democrats voted against the bill. Congressmembers Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Ilhan Omar, Ayanna Pressley, and Rashida Tlaib. Last week, they issued a statement condemning the bill and calling for the abolition of ICE. Congressmember Omar tweeted, quote, "We should not be giving one more dollar to support this president's deportation force that openly commits human rights abuses and refuses to be held accountable to the American people. Kids and families cannot continue to die and be terrorized," Ilhan Omar tweeted. The Senate is slated to consider its own border funding measure this week, including President Trump's original request for more than $1 billion for Customs and Border Protection and Immigrations and Customs Enforcement. Meanwhile, activists from the Defund Hate campaign gathered in the Senate Rotunda Tuesday to remember migrants who've died while in the custody of the U.S. government and to call for funding cuts for ICE and CBP. President Trump threatened Tuesday to obliterate parts of Iran if it attacked, quote, anything American. The message delivered via tweet followed Iranian President Hassan Rouhani saying the White House was mentally handicapped following news of new U.S. sanctions. Meanwhile, Iran said it would speed up enrichment of uranium, pulling themselves further out of the Iran nuclear deal as a Thursday deadline given to European leaders to take more decisive action to protect the agreement approaches. The U.S. pulled out of the pact last year. Back in the United States, Democratic Congressmember Ro Khanna and Republican Matt Gaetz unveiled Tuesday an amendment to the National Defense Authorization Act, which would enshrine the need for congressional authorization before any military action can be taken against Iran. Former special counsel Robert Mueller is set to appear for a public testimony before the House July 17th. House Intelligence Chair Adam Schiff and Judiciary Chair Jerry Nadler said in a joint statement, Mueller agreed to testify after they issued subpoenas Tuesday. Mueller's long-anticipated report found the Trump campaign did not collude with Russia during the 2016 presidential elections, but did not come to any conclusions regarding possible obstruction of justice. Trump responded to the news via tweet, presidential harassment. In New York City, Tiffany Caban appears poised for victory in the Queens District Attorney race. Caban, a 31-year-old queer Latina public defender, would become the first woman to hold the post. She ran on ending cash bail, stopping the prosecution of low-level offenses, decriminalizing sex work, and going after bad landlords, cops, and immigration and customs enforcement. Tiffany Caban claimed victory last night in Queens.
When we started this thing?
Yes.
They said I was too young.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Tiffany Caban holds a lead of just over 1,000 votes with 99% of precincts reporting, but her main opponent, Queensborough President Melinda Katz, says she will not concede without a recount and with over 3,000 absentee ballots remaining to be counted. Tiffany Caban's apparent win comes exactly 1 year after Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez won the 2018 Democratic primary, toppling Joe Crowley, until then one of the most powerful Democrats in the House. Ocasio-Cortez endorsed Caban in the race and tweeted Tuesday night as results rolled in, "We need a machine with a movement." Go to our website, Democracy Now!, to see our recent interview with Tiffany Caban. South Korean President Moon Jae-in said today North Korean and U.S. officials are holding behind-the-scenes talks in preparation for a third summit between President Trump and North Korea's Kim Jong-un. The two heads of state last met in Hanoi, Vietnam in February, but those talks fell apart after Trump walked away without making a deal. Although U.S. and North Korean leadership have hit a wall over the issue of sanctions relief, which North Korea says is a necessary condition for any denuclearization deal, Trump and Kim recently exchanged personal letters which appeared to indicate a commitment to renewing talks. The U.S. military reported two U.S. soldiers were killed in eastern Afghanistan today, one day after Secretary of State Mike Pompeo made a surprise visit to Kabul. Pompeo said the U.S. is prepared to withdraw its approximately 14,000 troops from Afghanistan, but says there is no timeline for such a move, and said the U.S. hoped for a peace deal by September 1st ahead of upcoming presidential elections in Afghanistan. Pompeo's visit came days before a new round of talks between the United States and Taliban. The talks have not included the Afghan government, which the Taliban refuses to negotiate with. Spain's highest court convicted five men who go by the collective nickname the Wolf Pack for the rape of a teenage girl at Pamplona's bull running festival in 2016, which they filmed on their cell phones. The ruling overturns an earlier, much less severe conviction of sexual abuse, which triggered widespread outrage and mass protests around Spain. Back in the U.S., Illinois has become the 11th state to legalize recreational marijuana after Democratic Governor J.B. Pritzker signed a bill Tuesday allowing for the possession and purchase of small amounts of the drug. The legislation will pardon anyone with a nonviolent marijuana conviction under 30 grams. Individuals can petition the court to vacate convictions that exceed 30 grams. Nearly 800,000 marijuana-related cases could be expunged thanks to the new law. The bill also sets up a program to invest in communities most affected by the war on drugs. Illinois is the first state to both legalize marijuana and set up a marketplace through the state legislature. The law will go into effect on the first day of 2020. San Francisco is set to become the first U.S. city to ban the sale of e-cigarettes. City officials unanimously voted in favor of the ban Tuesday, and Mayor London Breed has indicated she'll sign off on it. The ban also applies to flavored tobacco products. Proponents of the bill say e-cigarettes have not been properly assessed by the Food and Drug Administration for safety. The spread of vaping among young people in recent years has raised concerns about the long-term health effects of the products. Opponents of the bill say the ban could cause people to turn back to conventional cigarettes. Juul, the most popular producer of e-cigarettes, is headquartered in San Francisco. Employees of online home goods retailer Wayfair in Boston are walking out of work today to protest the company selling furniture to government contractor BCFS for its new migrant prison in Carrizo Springs, Texas. Last week, over 500 workers signed on to a letter demanding Wayfair stop working with the government in the detention and mistreatment of migrants seeking asylum in the U.S. They wrote, quote, "We believe the current actions of the United States and their contractors at the southern border do not represent an ethical partnership Wayfair should choose to be a part of," unquote. Wayfair rejected the workers' demand. Immigration rights and legal aid group RAISIS applauded the action, writing, "No one who works for a company profiting from these camps should be standing idly by as children are dying. This takes a village," they said. The Justice Department is alleging California Congress member Duncan Hunter used campaign money to fund expenses related to at least five extramarital affairs. Court filings show that Hunter used the money to pay for hotel rooms, car services, and bar tabs for relationships with congressional aides and lobbyists. Hunter and his wife were indicted last year after they allegedly spent $250,000 of campaign funds on personal expenses, including vacations and their children's tuition. Hunter's wife pleaded guilty and agreed to cooperate with prosecutors earlier this month. Hunter's trial is set to be held in September. Congressmember Hunter was one of the first members of Congress to endorse Trump for president in 2016. More recently, he came to the defense of accused war criminal Navy SEAL Edward Gallagher, who's currently on trial for allegedly shooting unarmed Iraqi civilians and killing a wounded captive teenage combatant. Congressmember Hunter defended Gallagher by saying that he, that's Duncan Hunter and his unit, probably killed hundreds of civilians while serving in Iraq in 2004. And the first of a two-night-long Democratic primary debate kicks off in Miami, Florida tonight. 10 candidates are set to take the stage each night. In order to qualify, candidates must either earn 1% support in at least three polls or gather support from 65,000 unique donors. In D.C., climate activists from Sunrise Movement protested the Democratic National Committee's refusal to host a climate change-centered primary debate, camping out in front of DNC headquarters overnight.
Become the model for a global large nation and show to the rest of the world that it can be done, that we can transform our economy and our society into 100% renewable energy. And we can do it within the next 10 years if the DNC has the guts to allow us to have a climate debate, because we need a president in the 2020 elections to have the courage to have a progressive and bold agenda.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Juan Gonzalez. Welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Well, Juan, it's great to have you back after your trip to Dallas. But can you explain what happened to you in the airport on Sunday or on Monday when you tried to return home?
Right. This was actually Sunday. On Sunday afternoon, my wife and I were returning from a conference in Dallas, and we were boarding a flight to Newark Airport when the flight had to, after being on the tarmac for an hour and a half, had to come back to the gate. There were a lot of thunderstorms, but then the entire power, apparently, in the traffic control system at DFW Airport went down, so all flights for several hours that were coming out of the airport had had to be brought back to the gate. So there was pandemonium in general at DFW Airport. But right on our flight, we noticed that there were several other passengers who appeared to be Central Americans, obviously couldn't speak English, didn't know what was going on. And so we sort of tried to help them try to figure out where to go to rebook, to try to rebook their flights. It turns out they were all Central American refugees who'd just been released from detention centers and were being basically shipped by the federal government to relatives somewhere in other parts of the United States. There was a young Salvadoran woman with a four-year-old and a two-year-old son, two-year-old sons. There was a Honduran man with a teenage son. There was a Guatemalan woman with a young with her young son. And in the case of the Guatemalans, they barely, not only didn't they speak English, they didn't even speak much Spanish. They were all talking basically in indigenous languages to each other. And so we tried to help them out, but they were totally lost, bewildered. They had no money. They didn't know. Most of them looked like they'd never been in an airplane before. And so they didn't even know how to figure out who to talk to or what to do. So we spent several hours trying to help them. But then we discovered that there were the American Airlines people were of no help whatsoever in terms of trying to assist these people because the lines were so long. But we discovered that there were several employees of not of the airlines, but who worked in the airports.
Contractors.
No, these were individual employees, maintenance people and others who have been now for months trying to assist these stranded Central American refugees, trying to provide them food, blankets, whatever they could. They were doing it all on their own time and putting money out of their own pocket to try to assist these folks. The airlines wanted to ship them to Minneapolis or to Miami or to Greensboro, stay overnight in those areas to get new flights to go wherever they were trying to head to. And as the employees started telling me this, they said this is happening every single day. And especially in the hub airports like Denver and Dallas and Chicago, when storms, these summer storms come and there are outages and plane cancellations, these migrants are completely lost and no one is assisting them, no one is helping them. So on top of the problems they have coming up through the border into the United States, then dealing with detention, once they are released, they are now confronting this total chaos in the system because the government is just sending them on their way with no money and no help, particularly the young woman with a two-year-old and a four-year-old, no stroller, all their possessions basically in knapsacks and bags. To deal with two children and have come from Central America and now even in the United States having no help is just astonishing. And of course, the average air traveler or tourist is just going back and forth, doesn't even notice what's going on right in front of our very eyes. This is happening in airports across the country today and has been happening for months. And I just think if anyone who speaks Spanish, who's in one of these airports and sees someone who's completely lost, any help you can give them, I think, would be appreciated.
And this is just a reminder, we were there a year ago in Texas, and each airport we were in, including Dallas, we saw a number of children holding those telltale plastic bags. When we would approach, when there was an adult, they would come over and say, get away from these children. They would say we could not talk to them. But the sign is those plastic bags for the kids.
It's just astonishing that this is happening in the United States in 2019.
Well, we're going to go to break. And when we come back, we're going to talk to Clara Long of Human Rights Watch, who was just at the Clint Detention Center, or if you want to call it a jail for children, where children are taking care of children. She'll describe the filthy conditions there. The news was yesterday, 300 kids taken away, and now the news is 100 are being brought back in. Stay with us.
Solo un besito más. Solo un besito más. Besito más. Sé que la luna cuando sale el sol se va, que la dalia más hermosa del jardín se seca. Sé que el invierno más eterno ha de acabar. las huellas en la arena con el mar se irán. Sé que no querías marcharte, sé que te querías quedar. Donde estés, un día iré a visitarte.
One More Kiss by Jesse and Joy. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Well, the Department of Homeland Security has moved 100 migrant children back to a Border Patrol facility in Clint, Texas, where children of all ages have been locked up without adequate food, water, sanitation, or medical care, with older children being left to care for the younger ones. Around 300 children were removed from the facility Monday following widespread outrage over the reports, but Customs and Border Protection said some of the children are being sent back, claiming that the facility is no longer overcrowded. Lawyers who recently visited the facility described a scene of chaos and sickness, with children unable to shower or change into clean clothes for weeks on end. Meanwhile, the acting commissioner of Customs and Border Protection, John Sanders, has announced that he is resigning in July, just 2 months after taking the job. Acting Immigration and Customs Enforcement Director Mark Morgan is set to replace Sanders. Morgan is an immigration hardliner who has been criticized for his past comments. This is Morgan appearing on Tucker Carlson's show on Fox News in January.
I know this may be controversial, but when the president referred to them as animals, I absolutely said that is correct. Those MS-13 members. And I can tell you, again, because I've worked it and I've been there as a chief, I've been in the detention facilities where I've walked up to these individuals that are so-called minors, 17 or under, and I've looked at them and I've looked at their eyes, Tucker, and I said, that is a soon-to-be MS-13 gang member.
That is Mark Morgan, who has now been moved from being head of acting head of ICE to acting head of CBP. That's Customs and Border Protection. He also reportedly was pushing for the raids on families around the country this weekend that was announced by ICE, but then canceled, at least for now. Well, for more, we're joined by Clara Long, senior researcher at Human Rights Watch. She was part of the monitoring team that visited Border Patrol facilities last week, including Clint, where she interviewed migrant children held without their family members. She co-authored an article for CNN headlined, "We Went to a Border Detention Center for Children. What We Saw Was Awful." Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Clara. Describe what you saw at Clint, where now 100 kids are being sent back in after the government said they took out 300.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Amy. You know, I was there as part of a team of lawyers and doctors who volunteer to monitor these facilities on behalf of the Flores settlement, which is a decades-old legal settlement between the government and lawyers for children who are detained by immigration enforcement. And as part of that settlement, we don't actually have access to the location, so to the facility where, you know, to the whole facility where children are being detained. What we can do is speak to them because they're class members. Basically, they are clients. So we were sort of placed in this anodyne, you know, interview room and given a roster of children who were in the facility. And when we got there on Monday, we got this roster and it showed that there were over 350 children in the facility from 0 to 17 years old. And so we said, okay, we're just going to start calling the youngest kids. We're going to start calling the kids who, the young parents. There were some young mothers there with infants. And we're going to try to talk to the kids who it appears, based on this list, may have been here for the longest. And when the kids came into the interview rooms where we were sitting, one of the things we noticed was that we were calling kids who were listed as being 2 or 3 years old, and they were indeed alone in the facility. They would come into the interview room, usually together with a somewhat older kid, and the agents would say, oh, this kid is taking care of that other kid. And indeed, what the kid said was, if you talk to the older kid, often these toddlers were pre-verbal. Oh, yeah, I've been taking care of, taking care of this toddler, because there's no one else to do it. And they're in my cell with me. So, I've been, changing their diapers, giving them food, making sure they're OK. And that was sort of how those interviews went. We ended up understanding from the kids that Minnie had been there for weeks. And the kid who had been there the longest who we spoke with had been there for 26 days. And that's staying in these conditions that are really inappropriate for anyone for that amount of time, much less for a child. They hadn't been able to change their clothes for the most part. If they had gotten a shower or a bath, it was on the level of, say, once a week. Same thing with toothbrushes. In fact, they would say, you know, we were allowed to brush our teeth, say, once a week, but then they told us we had to throw away the toothbrushes because you can't have them in the cell because they're contraband. So they wouldn't let them sort of take that kind of item back into these jail cells. A lot of them said, there are some beds, there are some mattresses, but, kids do also have to sleep on the floor because there are just not enough. That's the facility that after we decided that it was so urgent, we had to speak out. Oh, let me say just quickly, the other thing that really concerned us from the perspective of urgency was that many of the kids we called were visibly sick, running noses. Some of the younger kids had mucus-stained clothing. And then many of the kids we asked to speak with, they said, no, you can't speak with that child because they're in quarantine. We said, we'll go to the quarantine room, no problem. We'll send some team members to the quarantine room and have them immediately leave the facility if you're worried about us spreading infectious diseases. They said no. They never gave us access to these quarantine rooms, and we called a significant number of kids, almost, I believe, 10 kids at least, who they said we couldn't see because they were in quarantine. So together, that made us... Go ahead, sorry.
Yeah, Clara, now I wanted to ask you, first of all, in terms of how were you able to gain admission? Was this part of the President Trump, at least, the notorious Flores decision? Can you talk about how you got in? And also, who are the personnel here? Are these government employees or are these private contractors working for the government at this facility?
Yeah. So the way that we got in is through this now notorious for President Trump, Flores settlement agreement, which gives access to the attorneys for the plaintiffs, who are all children detained by immigration enforcement, by Customs and Border Protection. It was, back in the day, it was INS. So it's all of the agencies that took over from INS, including, of course, also Health and Human Services, which runs the big Office of Refugee Resettlement Detention Centers and Shelters for Children. So Flores Council has access to all of these, to speak with children who are detained in all of these facilities, where the facilities are licensed for childcare. This is sort of counterintuitive. The Flores Council has access to inspect the facility as a whole. Where it's not licensed for childcare, as in the case of the Border Patrol stations, Flores Council does not have access to inspect the facility as a whole, but we can speak with the children who are detained there. Outside of this settlement, there are really very few, if not no ways for outsiders, attorneys, inspectors, others to enter into these Border Patrol stations where we did these visits last week and another team the week before in Texas. They're closed to attorneys, they're closed to visitors, they're just very, very, very closed facilities. They're run directly by the U.S. Border Patrol, which is part of course, Customs and Border Protection. When you played that clip a few minutes earlier of now the Acting Commissioner Mark Morgan saying some pretty shocking and angering things.
So, Clara Long, can you describe the bracelets that some of these children wore, how you realize that, in fact, the government has access to reaching their parents, but aren't calling them?
Yeah, at one point I had this really quiet second grader who came into the interview room, and she sort of sat, she came in and she sat on this big office chair, and she was like grabbing the sides of the chair. She was like sort of bracing herself. And I asked her one question. I said, hello. I invited her, to speak and asked if she wanted to speak. And she said, oh, okay. And I said, who'd you cross the border with? And she said, my aunt. And then she just started crying so hard that she couldn't produce words. And, trying to calm her down, rubbing her back and looking and seeing that she had a bracelet on with the words in permanent marker, the words U.S. parent and a phone number. you know, someone had taken the time to write that down, I guess, when they separated her from her adult relative, her custodian with whom she crossed the border. So I, you know, at that point, there's this sense that you're not allowed to use your phone in the facilities. But at that point, I and other members of our team just decided, you know, screw that. We're gonna start making phone calls. So I picked up my phone and dialed the number and connected with her father. He had no idea where she was being held. You know, and you know, they were able to speak. And after that, she, you know, was able to sort of ask for more phone calls because she realized that, you know, phone calls might be a possibility.
How many of these kids had bracelets that had their parents' phone numbers written directly on them?
She was the only one who I saw with a bracelet with the parents' phone number. But there were so many kids who do have parents in the United States. I mean, another group of brothers who I spoke with had traveled with an older sibling to the U.S., a 19-year-old sister. And she, the sister was the one who had the parents' contact information. But they separated these kids from their adult sister so suddenly at the border that they were left with none of their parents' contact information. And they were distraught. They felt like they would never connect with their parents again. And so for them, you know, I was able to hook up my phone and hotspot and went on Facebook and sent a bunch of messages to the people, the profiles they identified as their father and their aunt, and someone got back to me and we were able to, you know, get the number and give their dad a call and send them, you know, back to their cells at least with a paper that had the number.
And where are these, when the children leave that facility, where do they get sent?
So the children who are leaving that facility are going to the Office of Refugee Resettlement, which is under a different agency, the Health and Human Services Agency. And they're going into what is now a extremely bloated set of detention centers and shelters. That's the custody that's being considered, for example, at Fort Sill, these sort of large detention centers are the new norm, really, under the Trump administration, like the one in Homestead, Florida, being run by the Office of Refugee Resettlement. I've been doing visits in those facilities as well. And, you know, the real problems that we're seeing there have to do with extremely extended lengths of stay, especially under the Trump administration. They've really slowed down the process to reunify children with family members in the United States. And a lot of that has to do with the administration's desire and policy to use the information of people who come forward to take care of children and get them out of these detention centers for immigration enforcement purposes. So to arrest, detain, and deport the people who come forward to take care of them.
When we were talking to Warren Binford, one of the attorneys who was in the center like you were, and I mean, is it fair just to call it a child jail? Are words like detention facility simply euphemisms?
I would call, in particular, the Border Patrol stations are jails. That is jail.
So when you were
there's no mincing words.
When you were in this child jail where over 300 children were being held, children taking care of younger children, often that they did not even know, a guard handing an 8-year-old, a 2-year-old baby who was sick and saying, take care of the baby. Warren Binford described the stories of the lice combs being given to kids and told to hand them around, a child with matted hair who wasn't given a shower. Warren Binford talked about the possibility of death in these facilities. And of course, we've seen one child after another dying in U.S. government custody along the border. Do you share the same assessment, Clara?
Of course. I mean, we pushed to request and schedule and go on these visits because of the steady rate of child deaths along the border in these border jails. And after going there and talking to these kids, it's very easy to see why those conditions can easily become life-threatening, particularly because of the, because of the infectious disease risks, the lack of hygiene, and the fact that when children are coming down with the flu or getting sick, the care plan appears to be to put them in a quarantine cell alone with no real childcare. I mean, there sounds like someone's coming in twice a day to give some medication. But no one's really taking care of them. And so it's very easy to see why those conditions are giving rise to death after death after death.
Well, Clara Long, I want to thank you for being with us, senior researcher at Human Rights Watch, part of the monitoring team that visited the child jail at Clint, Texas, where now 100 more children have been sent in after the government said they removed 300, held without their family members, their parents. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
A divided House approved a contentious $4.5 billion emergency funding package to address the border crisis Tuesday under growing pressure to address the Trump administration's inhumane treatment of migrants. The bill passed largely along party lines in a 230 to 195 vote, with some progressive Democrats voting in favor after negotiating to include provisions including new health and safety standards for jailed immigrants. Representative Pramila Jayapal of Washington State voted for the bill after pushing for those changes, but she had, quote, tremendous apprehensions about giving the Trump administration's border operations more money. The bill would allocate more than $1 billion for housing and feeding migrants in Border Patrol custody and nearly $3 billion for unaccompanied migrant children in Department of Health and Human Services. Four Democrats voted against the bill. Representatives Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Ilhan Omar, Ayanna Pressley, and Rashida Tlaib. Last week, the progressive congresswomen issued a statement condemning the bill and calling for the abolition of ICE. Representative Ilhan Omar tweeted, quote, we should not be giving one more dollar to support this president's deportation force that openly commits human rights abuses and refuses to be held accountable to the American people. Kids and families can't continue to die and be terrorized. The Senate is slated to consider its own border funding measure this week, including President Trump's original request for more than $1 billion for Customs and Border Protection and ICE.
Heidi Altman with National Immigrant Justice Center told the New York Times the administration chooses to direct the vast majority of funding toward enforcement, then cries poverty when it comes to diapers and food. It's a hostage-taking way of engaging in policy, she said. Immigrant advocates protested Tuesday in the Senate rotunda in honor of those who've died in the custody of both agencies, demanding funding cuts. As the Trump administration pushes for more detention space, including for children and families, we're joined by two guests. Democracy Now!'s Renee Feltz, correspondent and producer here, who's long reported on the criminalization of immigrants, family detention, and the business of detention. Her recent report for Rewire.news is headlined Willful Recklessness, Trump Pushes for Indefinite Family Detention. And before we go to our next guest, a doctor who's a whistleblower, if you can weigh in, Renee, on this bill that was passed and your experience in Texas, where you just returned from.
Yes, Amy, from what we understand, this bill that was passed late yesterday out of the House, which still has to be reconciled with a separate Senate bill, includes some $3 billion to, quote, shelter and feed migrants. But as we just heard from Clara Long, these facilities are hardly shelters at the border. And we're also being told that there was about that the ICE funding was stripped out of this bill. But it's been clear, as Pelosi has pushed to pass this, saying it's for the children, calling it a humanitarian relief bill, that Trump and his interim officials with DHS and ICE have also been pushing hard for this funding. And so is it really for the children or is it perhaps for Trump? There's been a lot of pushback from progressive Democrats to strip some of the key funding that would expand detention in this bill out of it. We saw that push by the chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, Congressmember Jayapal. But we saw pushback from four of her own freshman members on this. So, you know, you mentioned that I was recently down near the border. I went to speak with some of the mothers who were recently released from an ICE detention center in Dilley, Texas. It's the largest detention center in the country, 2,400 beds. I went there to film it at night, actually, and you could see with the football stadium lights on it how massive this facility is. It stretches like through a massive field, and there's tents on the site. It's disturbing to look at. And this is part of what people are pushing back against, continuing to fund more of these type of detention facilities. Interestingly, when I was in Texas, I went to San Antonio, and I spoke with many mothers who were released first from a Border Patrol facility and then put in this ICE detention center. And they said that the detention center was better than the Border Patrol facilities. But when I asked one mother what she would change about her time in the ICE detention center, she said, menos tiempos, less time. Hmm. So that's why people are pushing back on more funding for this type of facility.
And Renee, what about the provisions that were put into this bill supposedly to hold these, especially these private facilities, more accountable? Is there any teeth to that from what you can tell? Or
these
what?
Are private prisons.
That's right. These are immigrant detention centers, one's in a former medium security prison for families, and we'll hear more about that from Dr. Allen in a minute. But from what I can tell, these are some of the first provisions to try to push for accountability in a measure like this. So some could say that that's success. But, you know, enforcing that is, we'll have to see how that goes.
Let's hear from a young mother from Honduras who described her experience in CBP shelter, as it's called. She was just released from this place along with her 8-month-old son when you talked to her.
No, mire, nosotros ya realmente estamos
perdidos. We were lost in the river. After we crossed the river, we were lost. We were heading back, but a young woman stayed, and honestly, we said thank God when the Border Patrol arrived. They gave us water, they gave us some food, a little bit of food, but it was fine.
Faltaban cosas como agua pura.
Was there anything missing, like water, more food, vitamins?
Ropa, sí.
Clothing. We spent weeks without changing our clothes, not showering. We didn't have money for food or anything. It was tough to get them to give us water and food. They didn't give us that much. This was when we were with Border Patrol. We were in their custody for 2 days. We were in Mexico for 2 days without a shower, with nothing. We have not changed our clothes since we started the journey.
Are there any other details you would like to share?
There was a man who came with us. He brought a baby. The baby was his grandchild. The man was deported, and the U.S. agents kept the baby here because the baby was just the man's grandchild. It shouldn't be this way. We come here fighting for our dreams. We're suffering. And the man was deported, and the baby was brought here to the U.S. It shouldn't be this way.
So, Amy, I spoke to this woman who gave me her name, but we didn't use it because many of these people are seeking asylum from the countries that they've fled and come to the U.S. for. I interviewed her with help from Ariel Boone. What's interesting to me to hear voices like this, so these are people who are experts, ostensibly, about what the conditions are in these facilities, and the people who are experts are speaking out and saying, no more family detention, do not expand this, as the Trump administration pushes to not only hold more people, but hold them for longer in family detention facilities.
Well, we're going to break, and then we'll continue with Renee Feltz of Democracy Now!, correspondent and producer, as well as a special guest that we bring you right now, who is named Dr. Scott Allen, a government whistleblower who was hired in 2014 to inspect facilities where immigrant families are incarcerated. He's speaking out now on Democracy Now! Stay with us.
Can you see strength in my eyes? I used to sleep through the night. Then hurricane, there were no lights, no sirens, just guns. It was violent and we had to run or die. I'm running. I'm running. I'm running. I'm running. So much time wasted in 10, 17 years inside a fence.
Running by Gregory Porter. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
We're joined now by Dr. Scott Allen, a government whistleblower who was hired in 2014 to inspect family facilities where immigrant families are incarcerated. She's still on contract with the Department of Homeland Security's Office of Civil Rights and Civil Liberties. He and Dr. Pamela McPherson were shocked at what they observed during their inspections and raised concerns internally. Last year, they contacted lawmakers to speak out against family separation and family detention and continue to do so now after their concerns were ignored by the Trump administration. They were recently awarded the 2019 Rittenhouse Prize for truth-telling.
Dr. Scott Allen joins us from Irvine, California. Welcome to Democracy Now, Dr. Allen. Can you tell us what you have found and why you've decided to speak out? You are still on contract.
That is correct, Amy, and thank you for having me. What Dr. McPherson and I have been advising our government for really going back to 2014, but more intensively over the course of the last year, is that a policy that prioritizes confinement of children over care of them is deeply flawed. A lot of the chaos you're seeing on the border with the detention of children and their families is a predictable outcome of these flawed policies. And we made specific warnings against these practices really from the very first days. We first inspected the very first family detention facility in 2014 in Artesia, New Mexico. That experience was very important in illustrating that it's very difficult to keep children safe in detention. We found that in spite of mobilizing significant resources and personnel, that the facility struggled to keep children safe and in fact did not have adequate pediatricians or qualified health professionals to identify problems that were occurring right in front of their eyes.
And doctor, of course, this started under President Obama, the first family detention centers, and had been ramped up now under President Trump. And your sense, these facilities often are in rural, isolated areas where it's very hard, not only, as you say, to get the proper medical professionals there, but also to have any kind of accountability from the general public or even journalists as well. Could you talk about the problems you've had in being able to get the word out about what's going on?
Well, yeah, there have been problems all the way through with transparency of these facilities. They are run more like secured facilities that you might think would be appropriate for organized crime members or even terrorists, something where there's a great security threat. These young parents and their very young children do not represent that type of threat. And if indeed we were treating them humanely, we would be very open and transparent about how we do that. But in fact, the accountability mechanisms of which the Office of Civil Rights and Civil Liberties that I work for is a part of, as well as other accountability mechanisms like the Office of the Inspector General or oversight by Congress, we would have to say that they have all failed to keep children safe. And the evidence is now well reported in the news with the unfortunate news of child deaths that we predicted early on and warned the government were a very likely outcome of these policies, as well as the deteriorating conditions that children are held under, such as the reports we're getting out of the Clint facility.
So when you raise concerns that children would die in Artesia, this was in New Mexico, they shut the facility down, right? That's, can you describe what happened there? And then go on to describe what happened when you went to the jails in Carnes, run by Geo Group, and Dilley, run by Core Civic, the two private prison companies.
So, as I said, the Artesia story was a very important one for us because it sort of illustrated in very stark terms the dangers of trying to rapidly stand up facilities that will house young and particularly vulnerable children. Remember, these are children who have often been traumatized already, and the harmful effects of trauma are cumulative over a lifetime. So they're a very vulnerable population of children. They're also often in poor physical health. And the idea of congregating children together when they're often not vaccinated is a public health disaster. So we saw that there were a number of problems in keeping the children safe. And probably the most poignant examples that we documented is we looked at weights. I pulled the charts of every child there, and I looked at their weights across the course of their stay, and was really surprised to see that a significant number of children who probably entered the facility to some extent malnourished, given their perilous journeys, were not gaining weight in the facility, which is what you'd expect if it were a healthy and nurturing facility, but they were in fact losing weight, which is a really disturbing marker that we did not expect. And in reviewing these cases, we found the case of one infant, an 18-month-old, who had been suffering from a diarrheal illness and had become quite dehydrated. The mother kept presenting the child to the physicians. The problem was that the physicians were being rotated in on temporary duty assignments from adult facilities. They were physicians who didn't have a lot of experience in treating children. And they totally missed the fact, over a course of multiple doctor visits, that the child lost a third of its body weight, 10% being sort of the usual panic moment for clinicians to send the child to an emergency room for intravenous hydration. So when we identified this case, we were able to say to the government, it was a miracle this child did not die of a very easy to diagnose and very easily treatable and common medical condition. That we told them that they were playing with fire here, that the challenges of keeping vulnerable children safe in these environments were enormous, and that if they continued, and particularly if they expanded, the risk of losing a child or more than one child was very high.
Well, Dr. Allen, I want to ask you about, you filed comments on the Trump administration's proposed rule changes under the Flores settlement, which currently limits to 20 days the amount of time that a child can be kept in can be detained to indefinite detention. Could you talk about your concerns about this indefinite detention, given the kinds of conditions that you've already witnessed?
Well, yes, it's a very important point. First, let me start by saying that as physicians, we are keenly aware of decades of literature that show us that the confinement of children in and of itself is harmful to their health, leading to increased risks down the road, lifelong increased risks of depression, anxiety, post-traumatic stress disorder, and even physical health problems like heart disease and diabetes. This is well known. That's a result of confinement itself, the toxic stress of isolation from community. But this is exacerbated when the confinement is indefinite. The additional stress imposed by uncertainty of the future can increase the trauma. All of that harm is known before you even get to the types of things we've just been talking about. If you can't provide the necessary supports to care for a vulnerable child population, the harms can be exacerbated. This is what really distressed us, is that in addition to the known harmful effects of confinement, we knew that the government would struggle under the best of circumstances to be able to provide adequate resources to keep these children safe. And in fact, everything that's followed has confirmed that worry.
Dr. Allen, are you calling for more whistleblowers?
I think accountability and transparency is important. To some extent, I think the reason that a year after my colleague and I made these disclosures about the terrible conditions we had documented, the dangers to children, that it's a year later, and I appreciate the fact that the public is once again paying attention and expressing outrage, but I think the challenge is that we're relying on reports, on accounts, but we're not seeing as the public what's going on inside these facilities. Remember, for those of us who do get to visit these facilities and enter them, we're looking into the eyes of young mothers. We're looking into the eyes of young children who are suffering under these policies, and we see the human cost. I think most Americans, if they were confronted with the humanity of what we are doing here, would be outraged and would not tolerate it.
Scott Allen, we want to thank you for being with us. Medical doctor, whistleblower, hired in 2014 to inspect facilities where immigrant families are incarcerated on contract currently with the Department of Homeland Security's Office of Civil Rights and Civil Liberties, speaking out today about what he's seen on the inside. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
We turn now to look at the traumatic impact on the mental health of migrant children from being held by the Border Patrol and in Immigration Customs Enforcement detention centers. In Oakland, we're joined by Satsuki Ina, a psychotherapist who was born in the Tule Lake Segregation Center, a maximum security internment camp for Japanese Americans during World War II.
This past weekend, she risked arrest along at a protest against the plan to detain migrant children at Fort Sill, Oklahoma. The site of a former Japanese-American internment camp in World War II. Satsuki Ina, welcome to Democracy Now! We played a clip of you from that protest that Democracy Now!'s Renee Feltz covered in Oklahoma on Saturday. As you listen to these descriptions of the children, and you yourself having been detained, born at Tule Lake, what you call a concentration camp for Japanese-Americans, over 110,000 Japanese and Japanese-Americans were interned in the United States in these camps during World War II. What are your thoughts?
Well, Japanese-American community has come to realize that what is happening to children in these detention facilities is so resonant of the trauma that we suffered during World War II. And after decades of living our lives as compliant and quiet and demonstrating and proving ourselves as good citizens, many of us have felt that it's time for us to speak out, to protest, to resist, and to speak out in ways that we haven't in the past, because we know what these children are experiencing. We know what it's like to have family separation, to suffer the long-term consequences of the trauma of being incarcerated for some of us more than 4 or 5 years.
Can you?
We feel like it's really important to speak out.
Mm. And you are also a psychotherapist. So talk about your own experience as a child interned and what you're seeing about the children who are interned today, who are jailed today, the psychological effects it has.
So, yes, I was. My family was held for over 4 years, and I was born in a concentration camp. And the lifelong effects, I think, have led me to become a psychotherapist to try and understand what happened to us and recognize that these children today held in captivity, separated from loving care of adults, is very disturbing. You know, the reality that this is happening again is causing many of us to recognize that this is an injustice that is so discussed in the same way, presented in the same way, that we were a threat to national security, that we were an unassimilable race of people, that we were a threat to the economy of the United States. These are so much echoing what charges were made against us, that were unjust and without any basis. And these children are growing up in, you know, a time of tremendous chronic states of trauma. Captivity trauma is known to have lifelong effects on children growing up and resulting in depression and anxiety and post-traumatic stress.
We are going to break now, but we're going to interview you for part two and post online at democracynow.org. Satsuki Ina was born in Tule Lake Segregation Center, a